Across the Americas on Pan Am Saturn Galaxy, throughout Europe on the Astra satellite system, and around the world on shortwave and internet, this is the Dutch International Service. Media Network, the weekly communications magazine with Jonathan Marks and Diana Jansen.
Hello, welcome to this edition of the program, in which we have quite an in-depth feature on antennas coming up. But first, let's look at the broadcasting news.
And we start with homegrown developments, as it were. On Saturday, June the 10th, we're planning a bit of celebration here. This year, it's 100 years since the first radio experiments by Marconi. It's 60 years of the Netherlands Broadcast Transmitting Company, the NOZEMA, and it's 10 years since Radio Netherlands officially started using the new transmitter site in Flevoland. The old site in Lopik signed off at the end of March 1985, and the antenna park was dismantled shortly afterwards. I was driving by there the other day, and looking across the fields, you'd never know it had a shortwave past that put it on the dial of many valve radios around the world. But we digress. A week today, on June the 1st, the Broadcasting Museum on the south side of Hilversum is opening another of its temporary exhibitions, this time focusing on the history of the NOZEMA and the different types of transmitters it's operated in the last 60 years. A lot of the material has fortunately been preserved, stored at a place called Kootwijk in the heart of the Netherlands for many years, where the engineers have preserved bits of the past, including some of the first broadcast transmitters used in this country. Maybe you can recall the days when the Netherlands broadcast on longwave. That really was a long time ago. Well, as we speak, a team of designers is busy on the last-minute details of the exhibition. Radio Netherlands has offered to do its part to celebrate. We're the NOZEMA's second-largest client after the domestic broadcasting system here, and we're also represented on the Board of Governors. We decided to show how transmitters work in practice by setting up a ham radio station in the museum and operating with a special call sign for one day only, namely Saturday, June the 10th. We've applied for the call sign Papa Alpha 6, Romeo November Whiskey, PA6RNW, and that application is going through the official procedures as we speak. The ham radio station will be using antique transmitting equipment to match the rest of the exhibition. We'll start at 08 hours UTC and continue throughout the day until after 18 hours UTC. Until the museum owners throw us out. Look for PA6RNW to be active on the 80, 40 and 20 metre ham bands. The times again are from 08 hours until at least 18 hours UTC. One way to find out the exact frequencies we'll be operating on is to tune in to the regular English transmissions from Radio Netherlands on Saturday, June the 10th. Because Jeff Klebar and I will be at the museum following the progress of the ham radio station and reporting the contacts as part of the programme sounds interesting. The editions at 07:30, 09:30, 11:30 and 13:30 UTC will contain live segments direct from the museum where you can get the latest frequencies and find out a bit more about what's on show in the south side of Hilversum. Well, now the answer line, Hilversum 6724222, and a follow-up from a keen listener to the programme. Tim Hendel in Miami refers to the programme of May the 11th, when we looked at Hanoi Hannah and noted that she used a different tone to the propaganda voices in the Second World War. Tim makes the following comment.
During the Second World War, you referred to Tokyo Rose. There was never a person known as Tokyo Rose on Radio Tokyo. There were several women who broadcast English language programs to the Pacific, to the mostly American and Australian and New Zealand troops in the Pacific. These women were clumped together by the troops and known as Tokyo Rose, but there was no such person. Thanks a lot. As always, Media Network is a great show.
Thanks for the call, Tim. I think it depends on whether you believe Tokyo Rose is a term or a name. As far as the name is concerned, you're perfectly correct. Russell Warren Howe, a British author now living in Washington, D.C., wrote a book in 1990 called The Search for Tokyo Rose, published by Madison Books in Maryland. We We interviewed Russell 5 years ago and made a half-hour documentary about Eva Toguri, the only one of the 27 female radio announcers at Radio Tokyo who worked for the English service during the Second World War and who refused to renounce her US citizenship. After the war, she naively owned up to being the Tokyo Rose, and partly as a result of a witch hunt by newspaper columnist Walter Witchell, was brought to the US and tried for treason. She served more than 8 years in prison for her announcing work during the war, even though it was clear that she just read what was given to her. Eva Toguri was granted an unconditional pardon by President Gerald Ford in 1977. The literature about the Second World War does tend to say things like, Tokyo Rose said that so many warships had been sunk, when in fact they simply mean the female duty announcer of the day, one of the 27 broadcasters. During the Vietnam War, broadcasts to the US troops were mainly done by Trinh Dinh Ngo, although the name she claimed she used on the air as a broadcaster was Tu Huang, meaning autumn fragrance. However, listening to some of the archive tapes that Annie Sennett made around that period, there's another female announcer reading figures of US casualties, who could also have been branded as Hanoi Hannah. It all goes to show that every time there's a conflict and there's an English-language radio station operating from the enemy camp, you can be sure that the Western media will give it a popular headline-grabbing nickname. We had Baghdad Benny and Iraqi Jack during the Gulf War. Remember this?
To the American soldier in the Saudi Arabia desert, there is nothing more expensive than peace. Don't see fuel for the war machine. Your children are waiting for you. Your wife is waiting for you. You might have a lover. She's also waiting for you.
And so it went on. Remember, the British press talked about Argentine Annie to describe a soft-spoken woman who tried to woo the British troops during the Falklands conflict of 1982. On the air, she preferred to call herself Liberty. Although, because the transmitter in Buenos Aires was always badly tuned, she sounded like she was having a touch of the sideband wobbles as part of the bargain.
Hello, and Liberty. I have decided to show myself to the world from a place which is very far away from you and very close to us. I, Malvinas, Sandwich, and South Georgian Island. I am a voice, a spirit, a country. I am who can proudly say today, the world listens when Argentina speaks.
Liberty did turn out to be just one person, though, unlike Tokyo Rose. I'd be curious to find out whether recordings exist of Surabaya Sue, another English-speaking propaganda voice, or maybe more, coming out of Japanese-occupied Indonesia in 1944. I've checked the sound archives in Washington, D.C., and many broadcast archives here in Europe, and so far drawn a blank. But maybe they were monitoring observations made in Australia that still exist. Of course, unlike now, listeners in those days couldn't just slap on a cassette when monitoring the radio. Most archives just turn out to be written archives instead. While we're on the subject of the past, I quote from Rob Kennedy, who sent us a message from Birkbeck College in London.
Some of the documentaries I've heard on Media Network have been the finest pieces of radio that have come my way. So that's a big compliment to Jonathan Marks, Diana Janser, and the rest of the team. I think the most memorable documentaries, because they were so well researched, presented, and just plain interesting, were those on UK offshore pirates. And I recall the feature on Radio New York Worldwide, especially the car trip to the old transmitter site with the unspellable name in Massachusetts. The trip out to the dunes with Radio Bloemendaal, and last year, the stop-off at Trintelhaven to see Holland's FM-AM transmitter, and the recently repeated feature on the UK government's wartime clandestine radio operations at Crowborough. The one negative point about these documentaries is that unless we make our own recordings, then for us listeners, the features are essentially ephemeral. after the closing notes of the program's sig tune, They're Gone Forever. And that's a pity if you're a compulsive nostalgicist. Maybe it would be good if Radio Netherlands could make these archive features commercially available on cassette, but I don't think that the operation would make a profit. Maybe we need a station called Radio Netherlands Gold, broadcasting all their hits of the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Like the idea. Well, Diane and I have been talking about this, especially since those documentaries haven't been thrown away, but are sitting in the bowels of Broadcasting House here in Hilversum. I think Rob is right that if we issued them commercially, we wouldn't make a profit. On the other hand, as a public radio station, that's not what we're here for. Wartime Deception won an award in the New York Radio Festivals last year, and since we now have the ability to make compact discs here at Radio Netherlands, we're toying with the idea of creating a Media Network Gold label, a selection of some of the better radio documentaries about radio, like the features on the Falklands, the Gulf War, and clandestine radio. These would have to be limited-run compact discs to keep the cost to a minimum. We launched this as an idea only at this stage. If there's favourable reaction, then we'll pursue the matter further. You can drop us a line, give us a call on Hilversum 6724 222, or send us electronic mail by using the address letters@rnw.nl.
Radio Netherlands, where great minds drink alike. Sorry, think alike.
Now to a telephone tip and a query from the United States.
Hello, this is Joe Hanlon calling from Philadelphia, PA in the United States. I have an item of interest concerning Radio Jordan. I've been listening to them in English at a new time. I think it's an hour earlier because of summertime, at 1100 to 1200 UTC on a new frequency, 15170 kilohertz, and reception was fair to good here in eastern North America. I have a question for you, Jonathan. I'd like to know about the Radio Netherlands relay being used for Deutsche Welle programming at 0500 UTC in English. I'm making reference to the use of the Bonaire relay station. Do you have any confirmation of this and any background information on why you're using the DW relay? Thank you.
Well, no mystery about our relay spot with Deutsche Welle. We've mentioned this on the program before. We concluded last year that our English transmissions at lunchtime to Europe were still popular at 1130 UTC. But the reception on 5955 kHz via our Flavo transmitter site was variable in the south of the UK because we're physically too close and sunspot numbers at the moment are very low. The signal skips over the target area. So we feed the program to Cologne, and our colleagues at Deutsche Welle put out the show from Jülich on 6045 kHz. That's a transmitter site to the west of Cologne, a stone's throw from the Dutch border, if you look at the map. And 9650 kHz comes from Nauen, near Berlin. In fact, the old transmitter site of Radio Berlin International. In return, we give Deutsche Welle 2 hours of airtime over our facilities. At the moment, DW is using 17780 kHz at 09 hours UTC via our Madagascar relay station. The program is beamed to Southern Africa. And a broadcast to North America at 05 hours UTC originates from the Radio Netherlands Bonaire relay station on 5960 kHz. Each broadcaster retains his own identity. We just put out the programmes we're fed from Cologne, and they put out the programmes we feed from here in Hilversum. Now to a feature that always draws response, the subject of antennas.
Every day, there's something different on Radio Netherlands.
Summer's coming, and that means a lot of mobile reception is on the horizon. If you don't want to miss your favorite shows, then you need to take a portable set with you. But sometimes the holiday destination turns out to be a disappointing location for reception. Mike Spaulding from Colchester in the UK and David Cheng in Singapore have both written in with the same question. If you connect a piece of long wire outside the window to the end of the telescopic whip on a portable receiver, sometimes you get a lot of extra signals. But quite often, especially if it's dark, if you connect a lot of extra wire, you get an enormous hash with beeps and whistles. Jonathan went to see Willem Bos, who lives in the east of the Netherlands, right on the German border, where interference levels are low and there's plenty of room to experiment with different kinds of antennas.
Your antenna delivers thousands of signals. Some of them, especially from the very strong broadcasting stations, are lots of millivolts, up to 100, 200 millivolts. At the same time, you want to hear very weak stations, a shortwave listener at least, from long distance stations, they are just above the noise, let's say 3 to 5 microvolts. So what's happening now, in the front end of the receiver, all these thousands of very strong signals are mixed and they generating spurious products, intermodulation products, and they mask the weak stations. And that's the largest problem of modern shortwave receivers, and in fact it is because there are so many strong stations in the world with power levels up to 2 megawatts.
Then it's also important then that the antennas that you're connecting to the receivers are also not generating noise themselves. That can sometimes happen in the active antennas.
Well, there is a difference. In fact, if you use passive antennas, they do not generate noise. They're just receiving noise sources all over the world. Active antennas, some of them at least, they producing also intermodulation products, because most active antennas are wideband antennas. It means that they are receiving all the signals from 50 kilohertz up to 30 megahertz. Thousands and thousands of signals. They are all producing intermodulation, mixing products and so forth, which are generated in the amplifier of the active antenna. And that means that all these thousands of products generate a noise floor.
The problem too is with the active antennas that you're tuning around the dial, and even if there's actually nothing coming in, there's a lot of hash, there's a lot of background noise there, and that's actually coming from the antenna itself.
Yes, in a lot of low-cost active antennas anyway, the amplifier produced from all the thousands of signals which are received from 50 kHz up to 30 MHz, all these thousand signals generate very fast fluctuating noise, because in fact there are millions of intermodulation products, and this masks the reception of weak signals. That's the reason that a lot of experienced DXers don't want to use active antennas. But the last few years, some manufacturers produce antennas which are so good and have so low intermodulation products that the intermodulation products are lower than the atmospheric background noise, so you don't hear them any longer. And these kind of antennas, which are, of course, very expensive, they act the same as passive antennas with a lot of other advantages.
It's one thing if you buy a receiver that needs an outdoor antenna. I mean, you can buy these in the shops that are designed for the serious shortwave listener. The much bigger market is, of course, the portable market. And portable receivers themselves have problems because they must be very sensitive, presumably to compensate for the fact the antenna doesn't produce much in the way of efficient signals.
No, that's true. You have true problems with portables. If you listen at home, there is always a very strong interference field of noises and clicks and computer noises in the home. So you can only receive signals with a reasonable quality if they are much stronger than the noise level. So in fact, an antenna in the house is always very bad, but sometimes you have to do it because there's no other way. The other point is that the whip antenna receives signals with respect to, so you need a counterpoise. Years ago, most of the receivers were large and a lot of metal in it and so on. So the receiver itself is the counterpoise for the whip antenna.
It's the other part of the circuit. It's the antenna and the earth, as it were.
That's true. You're receiving on the whip with respect to. So nowadays, all the portables are very small and a lot of plastic and SMD circuitry, no screening at all. So it means you have no counterpoise. And it means that the level of the signals are much lower. So what the manufacturers has to do is putting up more and more gain. And this means also that you have a problem with overloading in countries and areas where are much strong signals, as here in Europe.
So what can you do about it? I mean, can you simply make a sort of metal tray and connect that to Earth? Does that help you?
Oh, sure. If you are able to connect a metal plate, for instance, to the Earth terminal, most of the receivers don't have them, but for instance to the minus pole of the battery thing, then you have a much better reception. It's certainly worth to experiment with it. On the other hand, some of the better portables have connections for external antennas. The problem with this is that the receiver is so sensitive that you have an attenuator to attenuate the signal from the outside antenna to a level whereby the receiver is not overloaded.
Is that the problem? If you clip, let's say, a 30-meter wire just with a crocodile clip onto the end of the telescopic whip of the antenna, all you hear is a horrible noise.
Noise, and noise again, plus a lot of very strong stations all together and intermodulating. So you receive a lot more, but you cannot understand it any longer. So most of the receivers with an external antenna input have also a switch, local DX. And that's also a problem, because you have DX, then it is much too sensitive. If you switch over to local, it's nearly deaf. So and you don't receive much more. You only have the advantage that your antenna is outside the house and the interference field is lower. But it's not a good solution.
There are simple variable attenuators on the market now. I've seen them in radio shops in North America and here in Europe. They're designed to control the level of the signal reaching the sensitive input circuitry of the radio. It's a sort of volume control in the antenna lead, as it were, rather than just a coarse switch on the side of the set. The German DX Club, ADDX, markets a portable attenuator for its members, which we found to be excellent on business trips. RF Systems in the Netherlands and other commercial companies also market attenuators. But for portable use, another way of controlling the signal level into your receiver is to take a coil of insulated, and I emphasize insulated, wire with you on holiday. String the antenna wire up in the room and wrap one end of the insulated wire around the end of the telescopic whip. Some companies, like Sanjin and Sony, supply a more elegant solution, an antenna which looks like a fishing reel.
If you use, for instance, on holidays, just 5 meters of wire out of sight the window, and you wrap it around the whip antenna, then with more or less windings, you can make the transfer of more or less signal. And then you have a capacitive coupling, because there is no direct connection between the copper wire and the antenna whip itself. It's isolated by means of the isolation of the wire, and that gives a much better effect.
Radio waves form part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and electromagnetic means just that. Without going into complicated mathematics, a radio signal is made up of an electrical and magnetic component. Some antennas are sensitive either to the electrical or the magnetic part, and that can be useful.
The point is that for shorter distances, you can make use of the magnetic field component. If you use an antenna which is sensitive to magnetic fields, you have the advantage that the noise generated by thunderstorms all over the world and electrical equipment, man-made noise, is mostly electrical fields. And you reduce the level of that noise and so on, much if you use the magnetic component of the transmitter. Point is only that you cannot use DX, because the magnetic field weakens a little bit faster than the electric field. And most of the time, loops antennas are used for lower frequencies. For instance, your ferrite antenna in your portable is picking up the magnetic component of the electromagnetic wave.
According to sales figures, loop antennas are getting quite popular for long-distance medium wave listening and the tropical bands. There are pros and cons, of course, with the loop system. You'll see a fine tuning control on a loop antenna, because it has to be tuned, peaked to the frequency of the incoming signal.
That means strong interference sources on nearby frequencies are filtered before they cause problems inside the radio. That's the good news. But at the same time, tuning is more complex because you have to tune the antenna as well as the receiver. However, loops offer an advantage in that they are sensitive to the magnetic component of the electromagnetic wave.
It's absolutely a quite good solution because you have a small antenna and it is selective, and it means that most of the receivers are very sensitive to overloading and intermodulation, and you are losing all that kind of problems. On the other hand, you have another problem. You have to tune the loop to every frequency. If you want to switch frequency, you have to tune the loop. Actually, you have to turn it also. So it's a lot of hands and feet work to receive something. But if you are willing to do that, then these small modern loops are absolutely good solution. Only thing is to warn the listeners a little bit, because there are also low-cost loops. And a loop delivers much, much less signal than a normal antenna. So manufacturers put in an amplifier, but they put in low-cost versions, a low-cost amplifier. And that means that within the bandwidth of the loop, there is tremendous lot of intermodulation, because let's say you tune a loop to 10 megahertz, it receives, let's say, from 9 to 11. So in that part, there's a lot of third-order intermodulation caused by this low-cost amplifier. So don't choose the cheapest solution.
I guess this is a bit like hi-fi in the sense that when people go into the shops and try to put together a hi-fi set together, the salesman talks about, look, you know, here's a CD player, here's a cassette player, here's an amplifier. And we add it all up, and oh, we need some speakers as well. And of course, the speakers are the most important part of the system when it comes to shaping and giving the sound. I mean, the final stage in the whole system. It's a bit like this in shortwave listening, although it's the other way around, that people sell you a receiver, and then the last minute, almost before you're walking out the door, the salesman says, oh, you need an antenna, just take this coil of wire and chuck it out the window.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. Of course, the receiver is the most expensive part in most cases. So, and everybody looks to the possibilities and price and so on. So that's quite reasonable. But a receiving station consists of two parts, the antenna and the receiver. And you can buy a very high-priced receiver in the 4,000 guilders price bracket. And if you use a piece of wire, then you receive nothing more or less than with a very cheap receiver. So you have to have a good antenna at first, and then you have to choose your receiver. And I think that a lot of people, they don't see that with a good antenna and a low-cost receiver, you can receive twice as much as with a very expensive receiver and a low-cost antenna.
Jonathan Marks was talking to Willem Bos.
And if you'd like more details about what Willem was talking about, drop us a line and ask us for the free booklet called Antenna Advice. Or you can read it live on Radio Netherlands' worldwide webpage. The address there is http://www.rnw.nl/rnw. Mr. P. Srirathsa in Bangalore, India, says he bought a satellite dish last year and now gets 30 channels on it. He found BBC World Service Radio on AsiaSat 1, VOA Europe, and asks whether he can expect Radio Netherlands there too in the future. Well, not just yet, but we are studying the possibilities. Mr. Srirathsa wants more satellite radio news though too. Well, okay, we'll add your name to the pro-satellite lobby.
Thanks to Omar Navid, writing from Pakistan, who responds and updates a feature we ran at the end of March about the changes to the media in his country. Omar reports that he now hears one of the first private stations in his country on 100 MHz FM from his listening post in Sialkot. Tests are also running in Islamabad using Capital FM, in Lahore using LBC, and in Karachi with a station called KBC. Omar says too that in his experience, shortwave listening in Pakistan is not as popular as it could be, simply because of the language. Few shortwave broadcasters transmit for more than half an hour in Urdu per day, and thus potentially reaching 70% of the population in Pakistan. BBC has an advantage over other broadcasters in that they use medium wave hired from Radio Nepal. Their English programs have a tiny listenership in comparison, simply because only a small percentage of people want to be entertained and informed in a foreign language.
Thanks for the input, Omar, and in fact I think that many pan-European television operations overestimated the power of English in the early days. Likewise, in Asia, you don't find these serious documentaries and scientific magazines as number one on the lists of things that people watch on English language television. When you come home at night, if you turn on the television or the radio, you first select a station that speaks your mother tongue.
And last but not least, my bird is on the line now with the propagation survey.
Diana, the solar flux decreased and the geomagnetic field was its usual changeable self. Solar activity was low all week and no solar flares were reported. The solar flux was 95 at the beginning of the week, and by Tuesday it had dropped to 69. The average works out to 81.1, which equals an effective sunspot number of 22, which is the same as the previous week's level. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the estimated planetary A index, range between 35 and 6, and that represents minor storm to quiet conditions. On Wednesday the 17th, the magnetic field was active with minor storm periods. From Thursday the 18th, the magnetic field was unsettled, except yesterday when it became active to minor storm again.
And what about between now and next Thursday, June 1st?
Well, IPS Radio and Space Services expect solar activity will remain low. The geomagnetic field is expected to be quiet to unsettle from today until Sunday. On Monday, we anticipate the magnetic field will become active to stormy, and we expect these conditions will last until Sunday, the 4th of June.
Thanks, Mike. And that's all we have time for in this edition of the program. Jonathan and I wish you a pleasant weekend.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.